Hey, I'm Jillian Caldwell-Clark, and you're listening to the third episode of Bespoke, a project and podcast on the media and how it works. What we're looking at today is just a little bit of the history behind the development of conservative media in the 20th century, as well as the development of our modern media outlook today. As Matt Grossman and David A. Hoffman wrote in their essay on conservative media and culture, today's multimedia conservative infrastructure reflects the conscious efforts of activists to mobilize popular conservative values and to counteract a mainstream media perceived as hostile to their beliefs, thus moving American politics to the ideological right. So I'm going to try and trace some of the history and some of this development and give context to the media world that millennial and Gen Z voters were placed in. Like I said, it's just a little bit. It is not by any means a complete history. There's so much more that I couldn't include, and I recommend taking a look at my source list if you want to learn more. Okay, so let's begin. In Dr. Julia Guarneri's essay, Progressive Political Culture and the Widening Scope of Local Newspapers, featured in Media Nation, The Political History of News in Modern America, the social and cultural historian describes the importance of newspapers in the creation of what became American culture and politics in the 20th century. She writes, "Newspapers helped to construct a broadly understood American way of life that would become a touchstone of U.S. domestic politics and international relations through the entire 20th century. When wartime propaganda marshaled residents' pride in the American way, or when radio or television pandered to audiences' commonalities, they did so using the shared vocabularies and shared values that the newspapers helped to spread. These shared vocabularies and shared values of the early 20th century and the earliest national news outlets would become a sort of sore spot for both the left and right wing of America's political spectrum. And embarrassingly, I kind of thought that the phenomenon of people claiming liberal bias popped up around the same time as terms like culture wars, which first entered the zeitgeist in the early 1990s. It was surprising to find that actually this was a tool the American right had in their back pocket for quite some time. It would first be used on a large scale in the late 1930s and 1940s, and by the 1950s, a group of conservative thinkers would come together to create the basis for modern conservative media, through their own publishing houses, newsletters, magazines, and radio shows. The crowning claim for these individuals would be that mainstream media had liberal bias, and that their news organizations in turn offered a balanced alternative. So first, a quick word on the history of journalistic objectivity and the idea of bias in journalism. You're on the edge of your seat, I know. In the late 19th century, it was still somewhat normal for papers and press to be partisan. Some newspapers had direct connections to certain political parties, and objectivity was not necessarily expected by their readers. Often, it was clear who supported who, and that wasn't really questioned by the general public. This was in part because journalism had not become a real profession yet. The first school of journalism would open at the University of Missouri in 1908, and then at Columbia University in 1912. It did not have the ethics and standards we know today. By the end of the 19th century, however, historian Nicole Hemmer identifies two different paths for journalism that were forming. One was based on the progressive movement of the time, investigative journalism that uncovered the corruption of modern politics. Think Nellie Bly in The Asylum. President Theodore Roosevelt gave this form of journalism the nickname muckraking. And although the nickname was not meant as a compliment, the journalists who practiced such methods embraced the label. The second path was that of the objective newsroom. This was not really a thing in any solidified sense up until the late 1800s. By the mid-19th century, the idea was there, but it was just one of many. In the late 1890s, Adolf Ox bought the New York Times. The son of Jewish-German immigrants, Ox worked his way up in the newspaper world and eventually became a titan in the publishing industry. When he bought it, the New York Times was struggling and needed a way to stand out from the already thick crowd of competitors. So the paper's new owner decided that objectivity was what would make the difference. As historian Nicole Hemmer writes, while the word objectivity wouldn't come into common use until the 1920s, its hallmarks, accuracy, fairness, impartiality, independence, and responsibility to the public welfare, were present in the Times reporting from the start of Ox's turn. By the mid-20th century, objectivity was treated as the standard. Now, as opposed to the norm of mid to late 19th century, big newspapers did not outwardly align themselves with specific political parties. However, like today, their ideological leaning was somewhat grumbled about in certain circles. In Lewis Raven Wallace's book, The View from Somewhere, he examines the history of objectivity as a golden and maybe unattainable standard in journalism. He doesn't disagree with the whole concept, but he has some questions about how it's been enforced. He investigates the idea of independent journalism as opposed to objective journalism. Wallace was fired from his position at Marketplace in 2017 due to remarks on a personal blog post questioning objectivity. He writes about his own experience with objectivity as well as the history of the concept in journalism. In his examination, Raven Wallace often points to examples of marginalized groups who were not allowed to tell their community's stories for the sake of objectivity. He points towards two journalists as historical examples of what independent journalism could look like. Ida B. Wells and T. Thomas Fortune were two muckrakers of the 19th century. A little prior or just at the beginning of the professionalization of journalism. Both of these journalists were excellent examples of talent in their field. Both were born into slavery and covered the Black American experience at a time when mainstream, aka white, America wasn't paying attention to what was happening in that community. And Raven Wallace points out that neither would be considered objective by later standards because while they worked from hard facts, they did not display the expected levels of neutrality. They wrote about things white reporters were not writing about that were important to them, and they made clear their thoughts on what was right and what was wrong. Raven Wallace points out that their careers are interesting examples of independent journalism rather than objective journalism. He posits that their work would make good guideposts for modern journalists today who are looking to cover unacknowledged issues while using hard facts. What's interesting for our purposes is that this outlook is also used as a talking point by conservative media figureheads for decades to come. More on that later. Okay, so fast forward to 1932. President Franklin D. Roosevelt is elected and brings about a new era in federal government. The Republican Party of the time is unsurprisingly not impressed, and while most newspaper owners no longer outwardly side with one party or another in the news section of their products, the editorial section was another story. Men like Frank Gannett, founder of the Gannett Corporation, Roy Howard of the Scripps Howard newspaper chain, William Hearst of the Hearst conglomerate, and Robert McCormick of the Chicago Tribune were all great supporters of the Republican Party of the time. And the pieces included in their editorial pages made that clear. Hemmer writes that for much of the 20th century, because of the prominence of these publishers, the main media complaint of the era was not against liberals, but against conservatives. Claims of liberal media bias did not really appear until at or around World War II, where the story of modern conservative media really begins. Okay, so now we're in the 1940s, and to quote Hemmer again, "For many conservative media activists, World War II offered their first experience as political and media outsiders. As opponents of American intervention, they found themselves on the outs with both major parties and mainstream press." Conservative thinkers and writers who were once comfortably situated in the mainstream now found themselves on the outs. So many of them began to form their own platforms. In 1944, the newsletter Human Events was formed by Felix Morley and Frank Hannigan, a former editor of the Washington Post and a journalist. In 1947, Henry Regnery founded Regnery Publishing. In 1954, Clarence Mannion started his radio show, the Mannion Forum of Opinion. And in 1955, William Buckley Jr. founded the National Review, a magazine that still exists today and would convince a whole generation of the respectability of the right wing. In the mission statement for the National Review, Buckley wrote that radical conservatives in this country have an interesting time of it, for when they are not being suppressed or mutilated by the liberals, they are being ignored or humiliated by a great many of those of the well-fed right, whose ignorance and immorality have never been exaggerated for the same reason that one cannot exaggerate infinity. Basically, what you need to know is that the folks that created these conservative alternatives were tiring of what they considered a consensus surrounding politics and spread by the mainstream media. The media and mainstream politicians, they claimed, were so middle of the road in their attempt to be objective that it was morally objectionable. And to be clear, conservative media influencers of the time were not the only ones who had a problem with objectivity and the gatekeeping of major legacy media. The left also had an issue with it. And yeah, I can see their point, although I don't think it's one that the conservative media activists were after. At this time, let's say post-World War II, the press in Washington, D.C. was one of the biggest boys' clubs around. The framework of stories would be discussed and decided on by those invited to the same dinners, cocktail parties, or sometimes real physical clubs. Professor of Journalism and Mass Communications, Catherine McGar, posits that it was due to this social, cozy, exclusive atmosphere that literal boys' clubs played an important role in establishing norms and consensuses, deciding what should be reported and what should be withheld. Understanding the pervasiveness of this clubby world is essential to recognizing how constant fellowship and togetherness could have inhibited radical thinking. It was very difficult for people of color or women or anyone who didn't fit the mold of society back then to be included in these rooms and in these conversations. And so there's a sense of irony that this was also the era of groupthink that frustrated people like William Buckley Jr., who was a white man from Connecticut. him and his buddies claimed that they were left out of a world and infrastructure built for people exactly like them. And when they felt that they were being left out, they were able to use the oftentimes personal wealth they had access to create platforms just for themselves and their ideas. Conservative media actors also made it a point to highlight that they were not offering a fix to the mainstream media, which they saw as brimming with liberal bias. They were simply offering a different perspective, still using the facts, but through a conservative lens. From the beginning, their tactics were to discredit mainstream media and present their ideology up front. So now, as you can probably tell, we're getting a little bit closer to what we have today. By the 1960s, conservative media had a space on television, with William Buckley Jr. reaching into American living rooms through the TV show Firing Lines, which aired from 1966 to 1999. And you can still watch some episodes of Firing Lines on YouTube. It's not something I can 100% recommend in good conscience, but something I did spend about 48 minutes of my life doing one day a few weeks ago. Just to run down the episode that I watched briefly, the phrase ipso facto is used before the first 10 minutes is up, and there's an almost unsettling calmness to the whole proceeding. It's a debate show, and it's funny, but in a very waspy, quiet way, and Buckley gives the air of that kid from school who wore a suit every day. The whole setup makes me think of two people with no interest in either team talking about a baseball game. And I don't love it. I also recently found out that apparently my grandfather really liked this show and Buckley's delivery. After taking exactly 1 second to be a little bummed out by that, I also realized that it was probably the first time for a lot of Americans that politics became a form of entertainment in this easily accessible way. People realized that watching people argue can be fun, and the networks realized that they could make a lot of money off of it. 1 year after Buckley's show aired, another giant of conservative media was making his own way onto the airwaves, and this time it was on the radio. At 16, Rush Limbaugh started as a disc jockey at his local radio station. It was 1967, and Limbaugh was going by the name Rusty Sharp on air. In the book When the Clock Broke, author John Gaines almost completed the amazing feat of making me feel bad for Rush Limbaugh when he quoted a 1992 Vanity Fair interview in which Limbaugh says, "I wanted to be popular. I have no problem admitting this. And I thought, here I am, playing the music these people like, they can call me and make requests. I can be a source of happiness, a source of satisfaction that will make me popular." It didn't. All it did was make people think that I walked the halls of high school as a stuck-up snob. And of course, it's here that I have to make the inevitable "men will really make a conservative talk radio empire before going to therapy" joke. There, I did it. Anyway, Limbaugh's style was very, very different from Buckley's. In a 2021 Politico article written after Limbaugh's death, Charles Skies writes, "William F. Buckley Jr. made conservatism intellectually respectable by saving it from the wackos and the demagogues. Rush Limbaugh gave it right back again." In a separate piece for the Washington Post, Skies also said that Limbaugh invented a new genre in which conservatism could be entertaining, even fun. And if you don't remember Rush Limbaugh, or like me, you grew up listening to Paul Simon cassettes instead of talk radio on long car rides, I suggest you look him up if you're really interested. his bombastic and raving style will probably remind you more of what we have today. Unlike Buckley, who did become a mentor and close friend of Limbaugh's, he is giving answers and not even pretending to ask questions. And while Buckley and his intellectual buddies certainly built the foundation for our modern media outlook, I think we can thank Limbaugh for really bringing it home. Through the 1970s and 1980s, conservative voices were heard more and more on television and radio. This was in big part thanks to figures within the mainstream Republicans, such as Vice President Spiro Agnew, who made explicit criticism of the press and its bias during the Nixon administration. And then, of course, we got Ronald Reagan, the so-called great communicator, who changed how we view the presidency forever. The 1980s also represented an extreme change in how Americans received information in general. In 1980, CNN began its 24-hour news cycle, and of course the 24-hour news cycle brought with it the unintended consequence of actually having to fill 24 hours a day with news. Additionally, after the Reagan administration, the Republican Party and conservatives were left with a vacuum for leadership and messaging. And boy oh boy, did the 1990s try real hard to fill it. In the 1990s and early 2000s, the house of conservative media grew. Rush Limbaugh achieved national syndication in 1988. In 1996, we were given Fox News around the same time as what would become its liberal counterpart, MSNBC. However, neither news channel really took its lasting shape until after the attacks of September 11th, 2001, and the subsequent fallout. And this is the point where I, and probably most of my generational associates, joined the conversation, or at least started becoming aware of the conversation. As you can probably guess based on the introduction in episode 1, Fox News was never on in my house. In fact, for my most recent birthday, one of the gifts I received from my parents was a bumper sticker that reads, "Fox News is my comedy. Comedy Central is my news." I think it's also important to say that I do not have a car. However, for many people from my generation, Rush Limbaugh and Fox News were their starting points for political media and communications. And while sure, you can believe that media simply reflects the culture of the time, I would say, and remember our last episode, some scholars might say, that it's a symbiotic relationship in which those in power have the opportunity to highlight or ignore what they want from the current culture. Not to mention that they get to choose how they get their messaging across, setting a standard for those watching that these professional communicators are communicating in this way, and so can you. This change in growth in media and information delivery also disrupted the mainstream Republican Party. Matt Grossman and David A. Hoffman write, "The rising power of the conservative media thus represents a mixed blessing from the perspective of Republican politicians and traditional conservative elites. Fox News, talk radio, and right-wing websites allow Republicans to communicate with their party's popular base and help to mobilize conservative activists and voters against the Democratic opposition. But the distinctive popular conservative culture that these media outlets both reinforce and promote is also fertile ground for repeated challenges to the party's existing leadership by self-styled political outsiders, including, most notably, Donald Trump, who are rewarded for their antipathy to liberalism and the establishment, despite frequent difficulties in achieving broad appeal among the American public or demonstrating skill in governing." Okay, on that note, we're fast-forwarding again to 2011. This is when a celebrity businessman and reality TV show host began calling in to a Fox News show to discuss the state of American politics. After 4 years of calling in and sharing his opinions, which were quickly gaining popularity, he would make his very first steps into the 2015 presidential race from a golden escalator. His introduction to the public and the media's response to his candidacy would cause Professor Thomas E. Patterson to write that Trump is arguably the first bona fide media-created presidential nominee. Although he subsequently tapped a political nerve, journalists fueled his launch. At this point, conservatives had a base of media networks and actors that was around for decades. They were on top of everything from print, radio, and television before leftists could even uncap their pens. And now they were on top of the internet as well. Tactics that we saw in the 1950s were being used by wildly popular new media as well. This new media consists of online shows in the form of podcasts, streaming, and other video or audio content. A lot of this media is independent from what we might call legacy media, meaning the old bastions of the media world, such as the New York Times or the Boston Globe. In an analysis done by Media Matters for America, researchers found that the most popular new content online was overwhelmingly right-leaning. From 320 online shows active in 2024, the study found that 191 were right-leaning and 129 were left-leaning. Right-leaning shows were coded as such if the show slash stream or host identified as Republican, conservative, right or right-leaning, pro-Trump, pro-Second Amendment rights, pro-life, pro-Confederacy, or libertarian. These shows or streams were found to be 5 times more popular than their left-leaning counterparts. When President Trump declared victory in November of 2024, he invited Ultimate Fighting Championship CEO Dana White onto the stage. "This is what happens when the machine comes after you," White yelled before thanking a list of podcasters and influencers such as Jake and Logan Paul, Theo Vaughn, and of course Joe Rogan. The conservative media machine continues to grow, leading to a spectrum of supporters, all with the shared tactics of early conservative alternative media, building distrust around traditional media and identifying themselves as an ideological balance to what they see as liberal media. Some will, of course, just be asking questions and give conservative influencers a platform, while others are decidedly conservative themselves. Either way, their structure is made of the same materials. Now, what was once alternative is pretty mainstream. Traditional media channels such as radio and television are overlapping with the success of podcasts and YouTube channels. And before I touch briefly on podcasts, I want to say, for the record, I really like podcasts. There are a lot of good ones out there, and I mean, obviously, I'm making one right now. I think they can be used as a cool alternative learning tool, as well as a good way for lots of people who maybe don't love reading or have time to watch a long-form video get information. And I'm not alone. According to a Pew Research report from 2023, about two-thirds of adults 18 to 29 said they listened to a podcast at least once a year, and almost one-half of adults between 18 and 29 say they listened to podcasts a few times each week. Podcasting, like its predecessor, talk radio, is a great way to make an audience member feel included in the medium. Unlike the stilted and maybe annoyingly high-end tone of firing line type shows or even a Meet the Press, podcasters have perfected the casual and cozy tone that makes you feel like you're just listening in on a conversation with friends. For a lot of them, there's also the added bonus that they're not journalists. They have no ethical standards to meet, no editors to report to. They can have and will give a microphone to anyone that will get clicks. even if it means they're allowing their fans to be exposed to something like, oh, I don't know, white supremacy or medically dangerous information. It's not their fault. They're just asking questions. The most popular ones aren't spewing the same hate that Rush Limbaugh was famous for, but they might have guests on who have or do. Between the authenticity, manufactured or otherwise, and the freedom to say whatever without any professional guidelines, it's just a deeply influential Wild West that makes millions, if not billions, of dollars. In the lead-up to the election, figures like Tucker Carlson, Ben Shapiro, Joe Rogan, and Theo Von topped the podcast charts. As River Page wrote in their essay for the Free Press on the podcasts that were thanked by the Trump campaign, none of these podcaster streams are inherently political, and neither is the UFC. They are not right-wing media in any traditional sense of the word. They are, though, the young, male, mainstream, representing a large but silent minority, one ignored by politicians at best and demonized at worst. And yeah, I definitely have my own mixed weird feelings on the ignored v. demonized conversation. Anyway, whether they know it or not, the conservative or right-leaning media influencers of today, even the ones that are not inherently political, as Page writes, are using a blueprint created for them by the likes of William Buckley Jr. and Rush Limbaugh. They might sound different, they definitely look different, but their foundations are the same. Okay, that's it for now, but next time we'll be talking solutions, maybe? Who's to say? Tune in then. Thank you so much. Bye.